So let's finish out talking about these two novel agents that have come into practice. And again, Jonathan did a great comprehensive review of both of these. Arjun, of course, we're talking about, first of all, erdafitinib, the EGFR TKI. And rather than go through all the data, and again, you can check out Jonathan's talk. Maybe you could just focus a little bit, Arjun, on sort of your impression, both in terms of the efficacy, you know, pretty good looking spider plot, but also tolerability, Arjun.
Yeah, so, you know, the history of targeting VEGFR inhibitors in bladder cancer is a pretty long story, but I think we're much better at identifying what the activating alterations are. We have NGS platforms that can do it reliably, and we have drugs that I think are good targets for it. And the 40% response rate, I think, is reflective of a good development strategy and a good drug. And, you know, the tolerability is unique. You know, their ocular toxicities, patients have fatigue, you know, they'll have, you know, skin and nail changes, they have hyperphosphatemia. And for, you know, for this class of drugs, which are very unique, you know, sending a patient to an ophthalmologist for a pre-treatment evaluation is not something that most oncologists are used to doing. So I think it's something that we've had to evolve and include. And then there's also, there's this dose titration based on phosphate levels. So when we treat our patients, we counsel them about these unique toxicities, but also tell, listen, you're going to meet more physicians in the course of your care because we need to monitor you closely.
So if you check out our GYN program next Tuesday, you'll hear about tisotumab vedotin as an antibody drug conjugate that's being used there in cervical cancer. And Jonathan, one of the things about antibody drug conjugates is sometimes they have kind of weird tolerability issues. A number of them have ophthalmic issues, as Arjun was just talking about. Can you talk about what's been seen here with erdafitinib? Because it seems pretty unusual. Central serous retinopathy.
Right. Well, this is a TKI. This is a MAP kinase pathway toxicity. It's seen with several other TKIs targeting these pathways. It's generally reversible when you stop the drug. On the bottom there, you see what are called Amsler grids that you can give a patient, you can have a patient print out, and they can look and see if there's any change in their vision. If they start seeing wiggly lines, they need to hold the drug and see the ophthalmologist. But over time, it can go away, but there are patients who do progress to more serious retinal issues. But it's a relatively small number of patients, and you can see here only 3% of patients had real problems. But with antibody drug conjugates, they'd get often, which is a different class of drugs, get some keratitis and some other issues more with the cornea rather than as much with the retina.
So speaking of antibody drug conjugates, that's the other novel agent we want to talk about, enfortinib vedotin. Arjun, can you kind of review sort of the basis of kind of how antibody drug conjugates work? Yeah. We have brentuximab vedotin in lymphomas, T-DM1 in breast cancer, sacituzumab is another one in breast cancer, trastuzumab deratoxin. How do these agents work, Arjun?
Yeah, in general, basically, it involves a antigen-specific antibody that is conjugated or linked to a very potent cytotoxic payload. You know, the advances recently in the terms of technology are mostly around the linker, which means that it stays very stable systemically. It's only only becomes really active when it gets to a cell surface protein that actually matches the antibody that you're targeting. And then in this case, in the case of enfortumab vedotin, it's a hydrolyzable linker that is endocytosed and really just has its intracellular effects. And it allows us to more safely deliver a highly toxic compound that otherwise would not have a therapeutic index if given alone, you know, systemically. And it also narrows the safety profile a bit. And so, for instance, with enfortumab and MMAE, which is the payload here, you know, the safety profile is, you know, skin toxicity, neuropathy, hair loss, and there's some hyperglycemia metabolic events. But we don't see much in the way of marrow toxicity, which is really good, especially with many of these patients who have had extensive prior therapies.
And Jonathan, maybe you can comment a little bit about the activity of this agent. It seems pretty substantial, and I hear stories from people telling me about cases of people have, you know, symptom improvement and, you know, good responses. Can you talk about the data, but also your clinical experience, Jonathan?
Yeah, so the data from the phase 1 and the phase 2 study are remarkably similar. In patients who've had prior immunotherapy and prior chemotherapy, the response rate is around 44%. We see the waterfall plot on this slide. We're showing the vast majority of patients have tumor reduction and that the many patients are ongoing close to a year or more. I've had a few patients who've had, you know, really almost Lazarus-like responses on the phase 1 study and continue on therapy for quite a long time. My own experience with toxicity is the three that are listed here: fatigue, rash, and neuropathy. Most of the time, patients, if they make it through the first few months, the fatigue is manageable. But the rash can be difficult, and the neuropathy can be progressive as time goes on and can require dose reduction and holding doses for neuropathy. I generally connect patients with the dermatologist early on in their treatment for enfortumab if they have toxicities from the skin toxicity, which can be very variable from just itching to macular rashes to papular rashes to bullous diseases even. It can be a handful occasionally to manage the skin toxicity. But, you know, in a patient where the drug is working, you really want to try to maximize use of the agent if you're able to.
So, Arjun, it just seems like there's so many trials out there where they're trying combinations with novel agents plus checkpoint inhibitors, chemo, et cetera. It's so hard to evaluate. Sometimes you only have one, you know, arm to look at. But, you know, this concept of enfortumab plus checkpoint inhibitor sounds pretty interesting. Specifically enfortumab plus pembro, Arjun. Any comments on that and where you see that heading?
Yeah, so I think this is probably one of the more exciting trials or the development strategies that we're kind of anticipating over the coming years. A little bit of context, I think myself and other investigators had noticed that patients who had had prior immunotherapy and then got enfortumab had what appeared to be immune-like responses, where even what looked like pseudoprogression. And then, you know, I had a couple of patients that I rechallenged with immunotherapy after enfortumab that actually subsequently responded. And so there was some at least clinical indication that there may be some evidence of immune synergy or immune potentiation with enfortumab. And so these two were combined as part of a single-arm phase one trial within the EV-103 program, looking at enfortumab plus pembrolizumab in cisplatin-ineligible patients. And what it showed, and what you know, Jonathan you know, updated at ASCO, shows that about 73% of patients achieved an objective response, 93-94% at least had some degree of tumor shrinkage. And the median duration of response has not yet been reached with over about 2 years of follow-up. So I think that's pretty incredible. You don't really see data like that. I mean, it's a 47-patient trial, and so we need to expand it and study it more. But I think these data suggest that this is something that could completely change how we treat this disease.
So we're going to finish out with a case from Jonathan. But first, I'm going to ask the audience another question, which is if you have a patient who has an FGFR genetic alteration, which of course you need in order to get erdafitinib. So in a patient who's eligible to get erdafitinib and enfortumab in general, what would your sequence be? Would you go with erdafitinib first, or would you go with enfortumab vedotin? And while we're kind of seeing how people respond, I guess, Jonathan, it kind of seems indirectly that maybe enfortumab is maybe better tolerated and more effective. How do you generally sequence these two, Jonathan, and patients are eligible for both?
Yeah, so I had been sequencing the FGFR inhibitor first, but for the toxicity and tolerability reasons, I've started to switch to use enfortumab first. I think, you know, there is something to target the tumor driver, and FGFR3 is a tumor driver. I've had some patients who've had a tough time on erdafitinib. I do think enfortumab has toxicity, it's often better tolerated in my experience.
Quick question from the audience, Jonathan, there's somebody mentions that they saw neutropenia and a patient who got enfortumab. You mentioned that's not too common. Have you seen that, Jonathan?
I've seen it. It's pretty rare. I've seen more anemia and more thrombocytopenia over time, but the rates are relatively low. The thrombocytopenia tends to be mild to moderate. You know, if it happens, it's in the 50 to 100 range, and patients can get anemic. But I have not personally had much neutropenia, and have had very few patients who've had to hold doses. But it does occur, and you know, everyone's bone marrow is different and depends on some of the prior therapies, I imagine.
So again, Arjun, what tends to be your first of these two sequentially in a patient who's eligible for both? Yeah. How do you usually approach that?
I think some of this could be just my experience with the drug. I have more experience with enfortumab. I tend to use that in third line. I've had similar experiences as Jonathan, which is that it tends to rescue patients from their disease. And even in patients who don't achieve a response, it has a significant palliative effect, in particular with bone pain, where other interventions such as radiation and others, you really can't even match it. So, and for the most part, because prior therapies can sometimes preclude, you know, because of myelotoxicity, I don't see much of it. I had one patient with very severe neutropenia, but that's about it. So I've generally used enfortumab.
So let's finish out just briefly hearing about your 74-year-old man, Jonathan. Also, there's a question in the chat room. Would you ever consider using either one of these agents before an IO, Jonathan?
So there's a tiny, tiny bit of data for erdafitinib. 12 patients in the BLC 2001 study were treatment naive and received erdafitinib and had a 40%+ response rate, but it's 12 patients. So I don't. If there's a specific contraindication for someone to receive immunotherapy, they've got bad lupus, they've got some other autoimmune disease, of course, you know, you have to treat the patient that's in front of you and not the guideline. But in general, I'm at the moment treating them post-immunotherapy, unless they're on
a trial. I guess as a measure of, you know, where we are today, you can comment on this 74-year-old man who I think maybe a year or two ago would have been heading for hospice.
Right,
at the point that he had severe pain because of pelvic involvement, high dose opiates. What happened when you gave him enfortumab?
Yeah, so essentially the third visit of treatment, cycle 1, day 15, he had been coming in a wheelchair previously. He walked into the office. He was using a walker, but his pain had improved dramatically. He was ambulatory from there on out. He eventually did unfortunately progress in the sacrum, different area in the pelvis, with severe pain. And we tried, you know, it was this oligo progression. We tried to do radiation to that spot and then resume EV, but the disease progressed elsewhere, unfortunately.
So thanks so much to our faculty. Thank you all for attending.